Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 3rd of December. David K. Johnston is with us this hour of the program. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He's written for Reuters and other news services. He won the Pulitzer in 2002 for enterprising reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. He's author of Perfectly Legal, The Covert Account. Campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else, and The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He'll be with us the first half of this show, and we welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, David. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Well, let's look at all the debate in Washington concerning taxes. Do you think that we are going to see higher tax rates for families making more than $250,000 a year, or will that figure be changed? And do we need that, David?
Well, we definitely need to have higher tax rates, and we probably need to have them on all of us, but at $250,000 for a married couple, $200,000 for a single person and above, we're going to see higher rates. Whether that'll actually start at that level or start at another figure somewhere between there and $1 million is yet to be seen. It is important to understand that when we had higher taxes, we actually had more economic growth. And there is exactly zero evidence have produced jobs and economic growth. In fact, all the indications are that they were a terrible economic disaster that went the wrong direction.
And give us some historical perspective. When were those times when we had higher taxes, and how high were they?
Well, way back when Eisenhower was president, a Republican, the top marginal tax rate on investment income, not wages, but investment income, was 91%. The tax records suggest that nobody actually paid that rate, or virtually nobody, perhaps except Ronald Reagan, who claims to have paid it, because people bought all sorts of tax shelters and there was lots of game playing. The top rate fell to 70% during the Johnson administration. Reagan, in two steps, lowered it to 50 and then to 28. Now, when Reagan got the 28% top tax rate, people at the top enjoyed an enormous benefit. But most people did not get a tax cut from this. And the news media's focus on the top rate focuses on a very narrow group of people. Then we went to a 31% top rate under George H.W. Bush. A lot of people blame his not winning re-election on that. Under Clinton, the top rate went to 39.6%. And during the 8 years of the Clinton administration, we had 2 years of balanced budgets. We actually had surpluses in the last 2 years, the first surpluses since 1969, and we had enormous job growth. In fact, more jobs were created during the 8 years Bill Clinton was in office than the 20 years of Ronald Reagan and Bush's father and son.
And what's the correlation between higher taxes and economic growth?
Well, I'm dubious that there is one fundamentally. That is, I can show you periods where we cut taxes and we had a lack of job growth, and where we raised taxes and we had the opposite. So I think the important lesson is that we have to pay for the level of government services we have, number one. Number two, we need to recognize that all private wealth is built on a foundation of common wealth. If you don't have a physical infrastructure, highways, canals, airports, etc., and you don't have a legal infrastructure of regulations, judicial system to enforce them, law enforcement, etc., civil and criminal justice, you can't have real economic growth. And what we've seen over a long period of time, and the data is real clear about this, is that incomes at the top have exploded, wealth at the top has exploded, and the vast majority of Americans are worse off. And let me just give you a real telling detail about that. 2010 was the first year of recovery from the Great Recession. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans that year was back at the level of 1966. 1966, when Lyndon Johnson was president, China was called red, and only wealthy people had air conditioning in their cars. The income of the top 1% of the top 1%, however, grew in inflation-adjusted terms from $4 million to $22 million. And in 2010, of all the increase in income in the U.S., and incomes did go up in the year 2010, 37% of it went to 15,600 households in a nation of 150 million households. 37% to 15,000 households, the bottom 90%, saw their incomes fall, even though the economy was getting better.
And what happened to all that money?
Well, the very wealthiest Americans are holding enormous amounts of money. Lots of it, there's good reason to believe, offshore, though Congress won't really fund an investigation of what's going on there. We have seen the very wealthiest Americans go from, in 1966, owning maybe a twin-engine propeller airplane, or a few of them having jets, to the very wealthiest Americans now owning personal jumbo jets. Sheldon Adelson, who put $10 million into the Republican primaries alone, owns two 747s for his personal use.
It's a lot of airplanes.
That's a lot of airplanes. One of them is equipped with so that his youngest heirs can skateboard in the sky.
I didn't even know you could do that.
Well, you don't have a private 747.
I'm pretty far from David.
And this is not to argue that people shouldn't be wealthy. You know, if you invent a better mousetrap, you deserve to get rich off that, okay? But at the same time, it is because you live in America that you have the opportunity and the market and the legal system and the infrastructure that makes it possible for you to become wealthy. And therefore, under a principle that goes back to 2,500 years, the principle that led to the creation of democracy, that the greater the gain you have, the greater the burden you should bear to maintain the society that made it possible, you shouldn't be able to live tax-free. And yet we know that there are many wealthy people in America who legally pay no income taxes. They just borrow against their assets and never have to realize any income and live tax-free.
Mm-hmm. Well, the president just won this election, and a big part of the election was that deficit reduction must involve higher taxes on the wealthy rather than huge cuts in social programs. The American people agreed with him. They agreed with him in huge numbers when it came to increasing taxes. So I would imagine that this is going to happen, right?
I suspect that it actually will, because you're seeing a small but significant number of Republicans break with Grover Norquist on his no taxes pledge. They only need about 25 Republicans in the House to break with it for that to happen. I contend that if you align yourself with Grover's pledge, that you are violating your oath of office, and I invite people to go read the oath of office. It says that without mental reservation, you will do what's necessary to support and uphold the Constitution of the United States. And if you are aligned to Grover's pledge, you're not acting without mental reservation, and I think you're violating your oath. Secondly, Kathleen, the simple numbers are that we will just continue in a terrible set of straits. Now, what's troubling is that just as Nixon, a Republican, went to China, because I don't think a Democratic president could, Obama, a Democrat, seems to be determined to cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, mm-hmm. even though Social Security and Medicare are paid for with taxes directly aligned to them, and Social Security is the best funded program the government has. It's astonishing to me that we are not discussing the fact that our national security budget is much larger as a share of our total federal spending than when we faced the very real threat of Soviet nuclear missiles.
Well, what about Social Security and Medicare? Are those programs, David, from your historical analysis, in some kind of trouble? Do they need massive overhaul?
Social Security does not. Social Security has a very minor problem, and the problems with Social Security can be solved if we had job growth, or if we return to the Reagan-era practice that 90% of wages are taxed. Right now we're taxing about 85%, 83%. That would mean raising the cap to $200,000 a year, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
That Social Security problems are very, very minor. The problems in Medicare and Medicaid are very significant and need to be addressed. American health care costs so much that it is that just the excess cost that we pay above what the French pay, and the French have universal care with no out-of-pocket costs and are widely regarded as having the best system in the world. If we got on their system, the following two things would happen. We'd have everyone covered instead of 50 million people without coverage, and the cost savings in 2010 would have been the equivalent of eliminating the individual income tax for everyone.
Wow.
That's how much money it is. Our sick care non-system costs us as much as the entire income tax system brought in 2010. For the current year, it'll be about 80% of what the income tax system brings in because the economy is getting better.
Hmm. I have follow-ups, but your time is limited, and I want to get to phone calls. David K. Johnston is our guest. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you. Right now, I guarantee you it won't be for long. He's a popular guest, so call in now. David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, morning, Kathleen and your guest. I wanted to raise the issue of a bait and switch in the discussion of the economy. Basically, before World War II, we were using a specious system, a system in which we had to have tonnage of gold in Fort Knox. Now, every economist has always known that there's never been enough gold in the planet to deal with all of the projects that humans come up with, all the roads and bridges and sewer systems and schools and everything else. There's never been enough gold. And so a fiat system is one in which everything that has been built and the education level and the vitality of a society can justify creating more money. And so ever since World War II, the world has been on a fiat system. And in fact, the U.S. dollar was pegged as the official currency that all other currencies had to compete against or compare themselves against because we were the bastion of freedom and we were the educational force of the world. Right. We were seen as the most vital country, and so the specie, the fiat system was based against the U.S. dollar. And since the Bush administration and basically since the Republicans have come into power, they've been bait and switching this issue and pretending that we're on a fiat, or they're pretending that we're on a specie system.
David.
Well, the caller is exactly correct that we have this whole group of people who want to tie us to gold, which is just silly. I don't know how else to put it. As Adam Smith pointed out, money has no value in and of itself. It's just the medium of exchange. And we can create money without, we don't print it. People keep hearing we print it. That's not what we're doing. But the federal government, the Federal Reserve, creates money. It's created an enormous amount of money. And you notice, by the way, that interest rates, despite all this debt, have been falling. They're not rising. There's no risk of a big inflation out there. Interest rates are falling. They're likely to remain relatively low for a long period of time because we don't have economic growth. And there has been a big switch in this. I think it's significant that the Republicans in the debate over what to do, they haven't put forth a single proposal for what they want to do except we will not raise tax rates on the highest income Americans, despite the fact that a majority of Republicans in survey after survey show that they favor doing that.
Let's go to an email from Carl in New Berlin. Are not the proposed tax rates the same on the first $250,000 of income for all individuals and the increase only on the incomes above $250,000, meaning the rich enjoy the same tax rates on the first $250,000 as everybody else?
Exactly correct. Everybody gets $250,000 if you're a married couple, $200,000 if you're single, at the same rates that you're getting them now. And the only difference is on marginal income above that level for those roughly the top 2% who make that amount of money. That's exactly correct. Now, in the long run, we're going to have to redo our tax system. That alone will not bring in enough money to address the needs of the country so that we can have prosperity. But for now, that's the only thing on the table. And so all the Republicans are doing is protecting the top 2%.
David, thanks. Mike in South Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. As a retired physician, I've got these suggestions. One, country needs a wealth tax. Two, we need to reduce military spending by 50%. Three, in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, we need to reduce payments to physicians and hospitals.
Go to a service model for health care, just like we do for police, public education, higher education, mostly, roads, and other things. We need to have a service model, and a lot of our problems will go away.
Do you think we need another stimulus?
I think that another stimulus would be extraordinarily smart to do right now. First of all, our infrastructure is falling apart. In addition to all the discussion in my book, The Fine Print, about the infrastructure and how it's damaging the economy and putting lives at risk, I have the cover story in Newsweek last week about infrastructure. And Sandy should have brought home to us very clearly, if other things like New Orleans and earthquakes in California did not, that we are heading towards a third world infrastructure. And the rest of the world is investing. Well, Europe invests 5% of GDP in infrastructure. We're doing 2.4. China's investing 9. We are using up our infrastructure. It is making commerce less efficient. And today, I had to spend $100 today to have my four-wheel drive Honda realigned once again because of what I call the pothole tax, because we're not repairing our roads.
Mm.
There is no free lunch here.
David,
and it would create a lot of jobs, and it would make commerce move more efficiently and improve the economy.
Yeah. Do you have time for one more call?
Sure.
All right. We'll go to Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if you were aware of the economic analysis of the top tax rates that was done by Thomas Hungerford at the request of Congress, in which he established that the only correlation you can make between changing the top tax rate is if you lower the top tax rate, it will aggregate wealth. If you raise the top tax rate, it will distribute the wealth across the board. Everything else was a crapshoot.
Yeah, Tom Hungerford's report, which Congress withdrew under pressure from some of the Republicans because it turns out Tom made a gift to some Democratic candidate. It may have been Obama. It may have been someone else. I don't remember. Makes a very compelling case. It's a very long and detailed time period. He does show that there is a correlation between reducing tax rates on the bottom 90% in income growth, but there's no correlation on reducing the top tax rate. That is, if the mass majority of people have a little more money in their pocket and they spend it, you get more economic growth. There is another study by Owen Zidar that goes down to the zip code level, as far back as we have zip codes, and county level data back to World War II, and he shows roughly the same thing. And I think the important thing to remember is there is no evidence that lower tax rates on the very wealthy do anything but allow the very wealthy to increase the size of their fortunes.
David, thank you as always. Join us again, please.
Thank you very much.
David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, whose latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. We're talking about taxes and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and this whole negotiating process that's going on in Washington right now. On Thursday, the Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner presented a proposal that calls for $1.6 trillion in increased revenue, some of it higher tax rates for families making more than $250,000 a year. There's also a desire to close loopholes, limit deductions, raise the estate tax to 2009 levels, and increase taxes on capital gains and dividend taxes. Republicans are asking for there to be substantial cuts in Medicare programs and in Medicaid, that they simply must be on the table in order to deal with the debt. And we're talking about all of that this hour of the program. Same topic, just switching guests here and welcoming more of your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open, and you can send us an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. tomorrow during this time period for all of you history buffs, which means all of you. John Meacham will be with us. John Meacham is the author of a marvelous book, very well researched and beautifully written, about Thomas Jefferson. It's Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. John will be with us tomorrow during this time period. Joining us now is Professor Andrew Reshofsky, Professor of Public Affairs and Applied Economics, faculty affiliated in the Institute for Research on Poverty, the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Postsecondary Education. He also is a visiting fellow at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, a think tank in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and his research focuses on tax policy and intergovernmental fiscal relations. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Same topic as we were on with David. 800-486-8655 is our number. Professor Andrew Reshofsky, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So as you look at the proposal that the administration has put on the table, what are its good points? What are its bad points in terms of deficit reduction, in terms of equity?
I think in terms of deficit reduction, it reduces taxes by, or increases taxes rather, by $1.6 trillion over the next decade. It also, on the spending side, cuts spending mainly in Medicare by about $400 billion. In the short run, as our economy is still growing slowly, those are the kind of deficit reductions we want. There are people out there who want even larger deficit reductions. Those will have to come in the future. But as a plan for the next few years, I think this makes a big, important step towards deficit reduction.
Mm-hmm. They will come in the future. Why not now? Isn't there an urgency of now?
No. In fact, there isn't an urgency of now. The real problem now, the fundamental problem in the economy, is still our slow, very slow recovery from a very severe recession and financial crisis. And the most important thing is to get the economy growing at a faster rate. And if we put the brakes on severely, there's no question that we'll fall back into another recession and to make the problem even worse. The long-run problems are really a problem of rising health care costs in this country. Partially, it's just the inflation in health care and how we fund health care, and partially it's because just the inevitability of demography that the baby boomer generation, which is very large, is retiring. But those are problems that we're going to really face and have big fiscal implications maybe starting in 2020, 2022. So in the long run, yes, we have to make more substantial entitlement reform, but that's not the problem for today.
Mm-hmm. Well, won't Obamacare help us with those costs associated with health care, or not enough?
I think it definitely will. Obviously, projections, everybody projects what it'll do for costs. There's some deal of uncertainty. Almost certainly it will help, but not enough, again, in the long run.
Do you see Republicans and this administration being able to fashion some kind of deal that will keep everybody from having their taxes go up significantly in January?
That's the $64,000 question. Can they do it or not? One argument that I, and I'm sure you have read in the press, is that maybe it's not so bad if we go over the fiscal cliff and taxes go up. It won't have a big impact immediately, but it will change the political dynamics, because then the discussion will be how can we lower taxes? How can we protect people, working class people and middle income people, by giving tax reductions? Something that the Republicans would probably be in favor of, voting in favor of. So that fact, the Republicans must be aware of that too, might drive them in the end, probably at the 11th hour, to compromise with the president.
You
but whether in the end that'll happen or not, I have no particular insight.
Are you suggesting that if we had had I don't know if we could have had a more rigorous debate about health care reform, but isn't it interesting that we spent all these years and the Supreme Court had to rule on it and states are now saying they don't want to deal with it after all these years in order to be a little bit more financially secure right now? We'd still need to change our health care system.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Let's go back to phone calls. Ron in Phillips. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, does anybody ever talk about, you know, the top rate for you know, the top wage earners? You know, used to be, I mean, I think they're trying to get it back to the Clinton era.
That's
levels,
correct.
Like
that's 39.6.
When from 1950, I think, through 1982, I think it was never less than 77%. And in the 50s, like all through Eisenhower's administration, it was 90%. I think it was 92% for a couple of years. It dwarfs what they're even trying to get back to now. And nobody accused Eisenhower of being a wealth distributor or a socialist. I mean, that was just, people just did that. I mean, the top wage earners paid that extremely high rate. Does anybody ever talk about that now?
I think people do talk about it. There was a recent study at the Congressional Research Service that highlighted the top rates and compared that to economic growth rates over the last maybe 5 or 6 decades. The top rates have come down dramatically. I don't think anybody would now argue that going back to rates of 70% would be good for the economy. But there is a lot of room in between, and many economists, I think, believe that increasing the top rates into the range of around 40% or even 40-50% will not have strong negative impacts on the economy. I mean, the economy is different than it was in the 50s, so. And we have a global economy. We have capital that flows between nations much more easily than it did then. So going back to 90% would in fact be a disaster for the economy. But that doesn't mean that increasing the rate to 40% would have a negative impact.
Thank you, Ron, very much for your call. Jonathan in Two Rivers writes in, Professor, a flat tax on wealth seems to avoid the claim that progressive income taxes are somehow unfair. I believe it would also stimulate business investment because taxes would be paid on cash holdings. Patents could also be taxed, so innovations could not be put on the shelf without taxes being paid.
So there are two elements, I think, to the question. One is a wealth tax instead of an income tax, if I understand correctly. And the second is a flat tax. And in the United States, the largest wealth tax we have, a direct explicit wealth tax, is the property tax on a form of wealth. We don't have broad-based direct wealth taxes. And rather, we rely on taxes of income, and the argument about a flat tax is one that everybody should pay the same rate, and that obviously goes opposite to a thought of having a progressive tax system, where people with higher incomes and more ability to pay are able to pay more of their income in support of government services than those with low income. So a switch to everything else the same, a switch to a flat tax, would simply lower the taxes on high-income people and raise the taxes on people with less income.
We go next to Randy in Cadott. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. I have a question for your guests. I'm wondering why our Congress negotiated with insurance companies, which are for-profit businesses, to administer our health care, considering the costs associated with their current system. And I'll take your comment off there. Thank you.
I guess the one word answer is probably politics. As your caller, I'm sure, knows, a lot of people in the United States wanted to have a single payer system, systems that are similar to systems healthcare and health insurance systems in Europe. The politics of moving in that direction just weren't there, and the U.S. is a country, and probably many countries, that move incrementally. And I think one can look at the Obama healthcare plan as an incremental improvement, where the main goal was to provide insurance coverage for not absolutely everyone, but a much larger proportion of the population. But we had to do it, and had to in a political sense, with the existing system. If we had said we would completely change the system, get rid of private health insurance companies, you could have just imagined the opposition that would have been mounted against that. Mm-hmm. And it's unlikely we would have had any health insurance reform.
Thank you very much for your call. Our number, by the way, here on the Ideas Network is 800-486-8655. We're talking about what people are talking about in Washington right now, and that is taxes and whether or not there should be an increase on taxes for the wealthy. We're talking about Medicare and Medicaid. Should there be cuts, major cuts in those programs to deal with the debt? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And Paul in Two Rivers is next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Kathleen. I wanted to clarify that that flat tax idea was not a flat tax on income. It was a flat tax on wealth. And it's that's a big, big difference. And there's a site, www.flattaxwealth.com, where I'm trying to moderate a discussion on that fact. So if your guest could address the differences between a flat tax on income and a flat tax on wealth, that'd be great.
All right. Okay? Thank you. Andrew.
Okay. I'm sorry if I misunderstood the initial question. We know that the distribution of wealth in the United States is extremely unequal. It makes the distribution of income seem much, much more equal. In other words, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but a very large proportion of the wealth in the United States is held by those, by a relatively few people at the very top of the wealth distribution. Most people have very little wealth, and the largest form of wealth holdings for most people are in their own homes, and with the housing crisis, a lot of people who had wealth, that wealth disappeared. So in some sense, given that a wealth tax is a tax on the wealthy, whether it's a flat rate or not is a policy question. If there are people with, let's say, $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 income and or wealth holdings, I should say. These are middle-class people who have accumulated for their savings over time. They are very different than the billionaires and multi-billionaires, the top one-tenth of 1%. And so the argument, should we be taxing even on wealth? People who are comfortably middle-class, and the very wealthy. Those are very different sort of people, and this is obviously a judgment, a normative judgment, that maybe the people at the very top of extraordinary amounts of wealth should be paying a tax at a higher rate than those people with modest amounts of wealth.
And what does an election where people agreed with the president on that, and he ran on that issue, how significant is that?
This goes beyond my expertise, because I think it's really a political question. One argument is it was fairly clear in the election what the president stood for and what he wanted. And given that he won, that should certainly strengthen his political hand. And perhaps many Republicans are in denial of that fact.
Thank you, Paul, for the call. John in Menasha, hi.
Hello. A few years back, I came up with an idea on the capital gains tax that I haven't heard anybody even think about, and that's right now it's flat at 15% for capital gains tax, and they're saying that they should raise it. Well, I've heard a complaint saying that, well, people with the IRAs and 401ks, when they retire, would be taxed at such a higher rate for those retirement monies. And my thought is, well, how come no one's thought of doing a progressive rate on the capital gains? That, you know, you withdraw $200,000 out of your 401k and you're only taxed at 15%, but if you make, $20 million, as somebody did, that you would pay 30% or 35%. What does your panelist think about that?
Well, in some ways, that's an old idea. And there's been a lot of discussion recently in the press of the tax reform of 1986, which was a revenue-neutral tax reform, so completely different setting, but nevertheless, it was a tax reform where the tax base was expanded and rates went down. The top rate went down to 28%, and all income from all sources, including capital gains, was taxed at the same rate. And a lot of economists are arguing that there are good arguments to tax all sorts of income at the same rate. And if we did that and continued to have a progressive rate structure, that would effectively tax capital gains, or those with higher incomes, at a higher rate than the capital gains earned by someone who had very modest income.
Thanks very much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about taxes this hour and tax rates and Medicare and Medicaid and all the negotiations that are going on in Washington right now to keep us from, for lack of a better word, going over the fiscal cliff come January 1st. What happens, and is it important for us to know what happens if negotiations fail? What will happen to average families, and will be the political consequences of that? We're going to discuss more of that with our guest, who is now Professor Andrew Reshofsky. He's a professor of public affairs and applied economics at the Institute for Research on Poverty, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and affiliate Wisconsin Center for Advancement of Postsecondary Education. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tomorrow during this hour, John Meacham is our guest. His new book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Carol in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling in response to an earlier caller talking about why would the federal government or even state governments work with insurance companies. And I just wanted to say that certainly we are doing that now here. I work as a caregiver and also a technical writing consultant, and because I don't have employer-funded, I mean, I have no access to a group health plan. I was very fortunate to get into Badger Care in 2009, and people with incomes up to 200% of the poverty level were able to get into that program for the first time if they didn't have children. And I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis on August 9th, which is really the first significant time that I've really had to use this program, and thank goodness for it. But I can see by getting all of the medical bills now, and I feel now like my part-time job is going to the hospital.
Oh, right.
I've had so many tests. But, you know, I see that no matter what the test is, that UnitedHealthcare is paying the same flat rate. And it's working out well. And I just want to say it's already being done.
I think the caller is right that Wisconsin really stands out among most of the states of having initiated a program of Badger Care, and the new Affordable Care Act will provide that sort of coverage to people with modest incomes across the country, and should actually strengthen the reach of the care for Wisconsin residents.
And thank you very much for the call. Could I ask, if indeed these negotiations fall through, what would happen come January? I have heard that the average family, and I'm not exactly sure what that means, would face an increase of $3,500 in taxes, which seems to be a significant amount of money for a lot of people.
So I think there's it's important to make a distinction between what will happen in January, February, in the first few months, versus what would happen if we go over the so-called fiscal cliff, and that's the end of the story. We don't; it stays in effect. Congress doesn't respond in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the latter case, yes, people will have large increases. The Congressional Budget Office and others have estimated that this increase in taxes and the cross-the-board cuts in spending, both defense and non-defense, cumulatively will probably drive the economy into another recession. So it'll have a big impact on absolutely everyone. But I don't think there's anybody in Washington who thinks that even if they don't have an agreement by January 1st, that's the end of the story. And going over the fiscal cliff will also change the political dynamics and probably make it much more likely that there will be adjustments to that, whether in January or February or March. And in the short run, yes, people's payroll taxes will go up by a couple percent. There'll be some cutbacks in spending programs that will affect individuals. But the impacts over the first couple months won't be very large, in part because changes take a while to implement, both on the tax and the spending side. So most people won't see a big impact in the first few months, and presumably there'll be extraordinary pressure on Congress to not roll back the taxes on the rich, but to give tax reductions for most individuals. Of people with low income and middle income families.
Rosa in Waterford. Hi, Rosa. Are you there? Rosa's not there anymore. John in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
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 Are you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. I guess my notion is that, you know, I see on TV and everything, all the politicians, when one of the politicians mentions something to cut the deficit or get us in line, they say, oh, no, that doesn't amount to enough. That doesn't amount to that much. But, you know, in real life, if you have financial trouble, what do you do? First, you say, well, maybe we better cut out cable. You know, we don't have to go to the show as much. We don't have to eat out as much. They are huge things, but they're a starting point. But those people don't seem to understand real life.
Professor.
I think the caller has a point that we don't need to, as some people argue, make $4 trillion or $5 trillion in reductions in the debt. Immediately, we have to take small steps. We have to put in place, ideally, what we would like to do over the next, and I won't say between now and December 31st, but over the next number of months, a plan that makes some small cuts in spending now, some tax increases now, but tries to begin to put in place some longer-term entitlement reforms and tax reforms. Those are complicated, both politically and practically, to design, and they will take some time. And we ought to start with making some steps now. And President Obama has suggested a number of changes and a magnitude of change that seems quite reasonable, and presumably there'll be some negotiation with the Republicans about exactly what those will be, with longer-run cuts in the future. And one of the things about entitlement reform is that you don't want to make big changes and have them in effect immediately. People need time and several years to adjust. So putting in place now reforms that will take effect over maybe the next decade or so is a much more rational approach to making public policy.
Thanks, John. We're going to try Rosa again in Waterford. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. 2 points. One, over 15 years ago, the Citizens for an Alternative Tax System, a nonprofit group, gave the prestigious think tank Cato Institute $10,000 to run a computer model study of what would happen if a national sales tax was implemented in the economy. And sure enough, it showed that there would be a huge improvement in the economy. And I agree with it. I understand what you were saying that, well, you know, it's not fair for the person that's at the lower income bracket, but that lower income bracket family won't go out and buy a Mercedes, whereas the millionaire will, so higher tax. And my second point is I have an uncle who's a millionaire, and he hides a lot of his income because of all his special loopholes that he uses and all that. And the thing is, with the national sales tax, the IRS will be abolished, and I think that's why it never went anywhere.
Professor Ruchowski?
So the proposal for a national sales tax has been around for a long time, and analysis of that proposal, if you ask what kind of sales tax rate would we need to generate the kind of revenue, and the people who are proponents of the national sales tax want it to replace the revenue from the individual income tax and the corporate income tax. And in order to do that would require, and I don't remember the actual numbers, but rates of 30 or 40%, extraordinarily high consumption sales tax rates. And there would obviously be pressure to have exemptions on various things. Oh, you can't tax food or medicines or drugs and so forth. And that would make the rates even higher. That being said, a lot of economists argue that at some point in the future, we should be moving towards a consumption-based tax, and it could even be a progressive consumption tax. One criticism of any sales tax is that it puts incredible burden on people with low incomes and reduces the tax burden on the rich. So there's the equity issue. But a consumption tax in the form of a value-added tax, which will probably stimulate economic growth. And we're not there politically. There's no discussion in Washington of a value-added tax. But over the next 10 or 20 years, I think the pressure for moving in that direction will grow.
Thanks, Rosa, for the call. Finally, in about a minute is all the time we have. Alan asks, will going over the fiscal cliff increase our debt because the lack of a deal will lower our bond rating?
I don't think the bond rating has anything to do with the size of the debt. It might, in the short run, it's a big tax increase. So it will make a big dent in the debt. I think the caller isn't quite right there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Andrew Ruchowski. Enjoyed our conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Andrew Ruchowski, Professor of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at University of Wisconsin-Madison, La Follette School of Public Affairs. He also is at the Wisconsin Center for Advancement of Postsecondary Education. Tomorrow, we have a very mini pledge drive that's coming up, and it's an important one. It's only going to be 4 hours long, and one of the hours will be our 9 o'clock hour tomorrow. Joy's 3 hours in the morning will be the other time. We're asking you to give at WPR.org in support of shorter pledge drives. Yes, your support will allow you to be entered in a drawing for an iPad mini, and you can go to WPR.org for details. So that's tomorrow. And to let you know, at 9 o'clock tomorrow, we'll be talking about books. We're going to have a great conversation. Daniel Boswell, who's filled with enthusiasm about books, he's Daniel Golden from Boswell Books. I don't mean Daniel Boswell. That's not a bad name. His name is Daniel Golden, will be with us. And we'll be also speaking with one of the editors editors of a really handy book. Read this, Handpicked Favorites from America's Indie Bookstores. So as you're looking for books, as I always do during this holiday season, just the right book for that certain person, listen tomorrow, get your pen and paper, and we'll give you all kinds of recommendations. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and this program, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you tomorrow at 9 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.